This podcast is brought to you by Lanco Group, your business partner for engineering solutions. You are listening to FNR Football Nation Radio.
The J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. I'm Ben Maxwell. On this week's episode, Alan Gibson and Scott McIntyre guest to review J1 Match Day 3 in a new East and West format that I'm trialling. And then later, John Steele will be along to round up the third round of the new J2 season. Before we get going, I'd also like to say hello and welcome aboard the good ship J-Talk to people streaming this episode on Football Nation Radio. If all has gone to plan, this episode will mark the beginning of our relationship with them. To regular podcast listeners, you can check out their range of football programming at footballnationradio.com.au. The J-Talk podcast starts now. Let's see, East or West first, tosses a coin, tails never fails. Let's head East. Scott McIntyre, welcome back to J-Talk. How are you?
Hello, Benjamin Maxwell. For the longest time, I was confused, and to be honest, I still am. I'm sure you don't know where I'm going with this, but the map of Japan, this East and West business, for me, I always thought, and I still think, it makes more sense to go north and south, no?
Well, there are definitely north and south parts of Japan. You're definitely correct there, Scott. But I guess from a central part, kind of around the elbow of the island of Honshu, I guess there's an east and a north from there, and then there's a west and a south as well. So, yeah.
So what are all the Kyushu?
Well, Kyushu
mobs?
Is certainly towards the south, isn't it? But the southwest, perhaps.
Hmm. Mm. But it's still considered to be west, right?
Well, I don't know. Yeah, it's definitely towards the southerly part of south. Yes, I think.
Which means Sendai and Sapporo is still considered to be east.
Well, no, that is most definitely north, isn't it? Yeah, northeast. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, but I don't know. No, of course it's north. Yeah, it's the top.
It's right, yeah, the top. I know, but people still just divide stuff into east and west.
Yeah,
the whole country.
I don't know. Yeah. Well, it's rather than confusing the listeners with four different directions, I just chose to go with two, and you've just thrown my plans into disarray.
Well, next time you've got to do a four-pronged podcast then and get... have you got any... Oh, you've got Jay up in Sapporo. You've got... I'm sure you've got some spies down in the south. Have you got anyone in Okinawa?
That's funny you mentioned that. There might be a... a new a fellow Aussie has come on the scene. He might be starting to blog about FC Ryukyu. I believe it's at Okinawa Aussie on Twitter. Look him up once we've finished, Scott, because
nice.
You might be hearing from him on J Talk at some point this season if they keep on winning all their games. I'm absolutely definitely going to have him on.
Yeah, but, no, it's good.
Indeed. All right, well, so, yeah, whether it's west and east or north and south or whatever, I've got you on to go through basically half of the games from match day three. So let's begin with the two big games. Well, one of them was definitely a big game at the Nissan Stadium, just over 36,000 there to see a Kanagawa derby between Yokohama and Kawasaki, and the teams, they split the spoils at the end of the day. An early flourish from Kawasaki was cancelled out by Marcos Junior, Scott, and then a late drama at both ends with Leandro Damião finishing off his brace before Takahiro Ogihara had the last word. But there was a lot going on in the meantime, and I can't imagine how you were feeling while this game was going on. You mustn't have known what to do with yourself. Two of your J-League favourites clashing.
I promise I will let this go in a minute, but I realise the reason why I'm confused. It's because bloody North and South Korea are right next door. That's what's confusing me, because it's not East Korea and West Korea. Anyway, I'm going to let that go now. But you're totally right. For me, I remember many times on the podcast last year, I would come up with the same refrain that I thought last year was one of the worst years that we've seen across the board. And I think this year it's completely changed. I don't know what it has to be, simply down to the maybe this influx of new coaches. We seem to have swept away a lot of the dour kind of defensive-minded coaches, in my opinion, thankfully, for that. And we've got, generally speaking, I think, a crop of coaches that really like to attack. I mean, I remember I mentioned to you after the first Oita game as well, and I'm sure we'll come on to them in a little bit, but they've just been absolutely fantastic under this coach, Katanosaka, who I didn't really know too much about, but he's come and basically had a go at any team. Doesn't matter if you're playing the ASEAN champions away or whatever. So, whereas, you know, last year we were kind of blessed with only a couple of attack-minded teams, these being two of them. Now the pool has has certainly deepened, which I really, really like. But again, this was just a fine example of two teams that, and you heard Ange Postecoglou at the end of the game, he said it quite clearly, two teams that wanted to win the game, which is such a key idea of football, right? I mean, we want to go and win. But so often we've seen in the J-League this conservative thing where teams are more concerned, in my opinion, about trying not to lose than win. So it was fantastic to see two clubs like that coming together. I think it probably showed a little bit also the evolution along the path of that, where Kawasaki looked a lot more cohesive, a lot more crisp in their passing, a lot more understanding of the space off the ball. I don't know how much of that, although I suspect a lot of it had to do with the fact that Koji Miyoshi, I know he's got his customary mention yes. on the pod early doors, but I mean, he's been, he's been so good in terms of just fitting in and being the ideal kind of player that Postecoglou needs, you know, to make his system operate. So him not being there, obviously he's not eligible to play his parent club, and still, I know, heard you had Neil on a couple of editions ago, you know, he felt that maybe there wasn't a spot for Miyoshi in that team. I think, geez, you would imagine that he would walk straight into the team. He's not a natural fit. Maybe they think, okay, one more year for Kengo, and then he can be the guy to take over from Kengo. But a player like that, you know, he showed it at Sapporo and he showed it at Marinos, and it was really evident that he wasn't there on the weekend. Things just weren't as fluent, you know, as they had been up to this point. But the great thing about Marinos under Postecoglou, and I keep saying it every week, and what's a stereotypical Spanish name, a first name of a Spaniard? Yeah. I don't know, Manuel or Juan or something like this. Mm. So I think if it was Juan Postecoglou or Manuel Postecoglou, he would be being fawned over by the Japanese media in the same way that we see this other influx of Spanish coaches, not just in J1, we should also remember in J2. And they seem to be the talk of of football. You know, there's people coming from this, you know, deep football background, and they're revolutionising the game, bringing all these elements to Japan. I think people still look at Postecoglou and think, well, what this crazy man is doing. They're not quite sure exactly of what it's about. Because, and honestly, I think it's because he's from Australia. But I said it to you earlier. I honestly believe in tactically, and, you know, I have a fair understanding you know, of what goes into the coaching that he puts into the club. And I can tell you, really, you know, so much work is done, you know, deep drilling and deep diving into really small details of positioning and movement, and every single aspect of it is properly coached and properly designed and properly executed. It's not a mistake. But if you watch these games, what they're doing is, in my opinion, more aggressive than what Kawasaki are doing. They're coming from somehow the same kind of base platform, where they both want to be attacking, hold possession, and look to dominate the opponent. But I think my opinion is Marinos are doing it to a degree three or four notches up on the dial. I mean, if you look at the game, I did this with a friend of mine the other night, just took out a random game, went to a random minute and paused it when they're in possession. And if you freeze frame it, I mean, more often than not, they have at least four, and often more than that, players inside the opposition penalty box. And I don't mean like on you know, random counters, or they don't play any kind of long balls, but if there was a long ball coming in, they just aggressively push to this point where they're so confident in what they're doing that they're happy to be in such a dangerous, in we could say inverted commas, position on the pitch, and still looking to play in and around the box. And if you've got that many players, I mean, you're going to create a lot of opportunities. They've fixed a lot of the defensive issues, not all of them, but you know, again, we saw on multiple occasions in this game against Frontale that they got caught out up the pitch. But whereas last year they had a 41-year-old guy kind of not even jogging is the right word to try and get back, but this year, you know, you've got guys like Katanaka and Thiago Martins, you know, quick enough to get back in a few occasions in particular. I've been really impressed with Thiago Martins, aside from the the rather dashing moustache that he has, is a very good player. And of course, he has to be comfortable in possession, playing so high up the pitch as I do, but also he's very good in getting back and stopping those counterattacks. And yeah, I mean, really, maybe Kawasaki were a little bit unlucky in one way to get away with it. But then, again, it just shows the, you know, the relentless positivity of Marinos not to give up. And, geez, I'll tell you, it was almost the highlight of my life with Hiroki Yuku coming very, very close to getting the final touch on that goal that went in. He's come up for the late set piece. And I keep saying someday someone is going to write a book about this guy's life and it's going to be a bestseller. And to see him with his little kind of Bushman's beard up there in the opposition penalty box, kind of breaking free and coming within like a whisker of getting his foot on the ball before it crossed the line, that just would have made my year if the equalising goal had been scored by the great Hiroki Yukura. But in the end, 2-2, it's not an unfair result. And, you know, yet another fantastic spectacle and advertisement for the kind of football that I like to see.
Indeed. I mean, it would have been a good redemption story for Ikura after his, I wouldn't say loose pass out of defence, but a pass that slightly missed its mark and was, collected by Al Tanaka, somebody who we've already mentioned a couple of times this season. And his fantastic through ball founder Leandro Damião, who dinked Ikura in just the fourth minute. So, yeah, if he could have got that final touch to Takahiro Ogihara's header in the 95th minute, which proved to be literally the last touch of the game to rescue a point for F. Marinos, then, yeah, that would have been quite the story. So, I mean, they were literally 2 seconds away from failing to take anything away from this game. But I guess, the way you're feeling about Yokohama these days is that would have just been a minor bump in the road, and that their performances through the first three games have, you were still a big rat for them last year, but have really kicked on this year, and some personnel that they've added have, I'm sure you'll say, have added a different dimension to the way they go about things as well.
Yeah, absolutely. We should put it in the context of Kawasaki rotated a couple of players in this game, key players in Kobayashi and Nakamura. And the only reason that Al Tanaka was playing was because I believe Oshman was injured in the warm-ups, right? He was a late...
They only had six subs, so I presume that must have had been, yeah.
Yeah. But I think the thing with Marinos is that it's not been about pursuing results. And that was the message right from, you know, that the beginning last year when things didn't really start well. And we've seen this with pretty much every team that Postecoglou has had, that they've struggled in some cases for the whole first season, as they did with Marinos. And then in the second season, it's really clicked because it's, like I said, the way that they train is incredibly detailed and incredibly precise, and it takes a long time and a lot of detailed tactical understanding to be able to play that aggressively. I mean, it's, we'll say it time and time again, how easy is it to sit back and defend and play on the counter? Like, you, me, and Alan Gibson can organise a team in that way. It's not particularly difficult to do, but to be so aggressive and so dominant in games, it, you must be completely in sync with, you know, every member of the team, and the way, you know, particularly the way that they're playing with the, you know, these kind of inverted fullbacks that you've got playing as number sixes and everybody being pushed up the pitch. And in the case of Marinos, it's almost the entire game that they're literally 10 players are in the opposition half. So, but if you do it and you practice and you practice and you do it and you do it and you practice, it's gonna lead to results. And I think that's the thing this year. Okay, sure, there's been some good additions to the squad. And I keep saying that this Edgara Jr. I told you about in pre-season, he didn't score in this game, but I think absolutely he's gonna win the Golden Boot, and he could set all sorts of records. This was their worst performance, I think, Marinos, of the season. A lot of that had to do with Miyoshi missing, but I think they're going to smack teams by double. I think they're going to. It wouldn't surprise me if they cracked double figures in a game this year. I mean, so dominant are they, and it's usually these kind of teams, and this is why I think it's good for Marinos overall this year, because last year you had so many clubs that would just simply sit and not try to play them, and then pick them off on the counter, or as we saw, Ikura got lobbed from halfway three or four times as well. But with this year, with so many more attack minded coaches in the league, teams are prepared to come and play, and I think it's a very, very dangerous exercise. And I think, I don't know who it is, but I think some team, you can get me on the pod the week after, is going to be on the end of an almighty spanking this year when they really click.
Yes, indeed. All right. Well, so you mentioned Edgar Junior there. So, I mean, this game featured two likely candidates for the Golden Boot, and Leandro Damião was the one who emerged victorious in that particular duel, of course, with his two goals for Frontale on the afternoon. So, I mean, Sean Carroll...
No, the second one, I don't know, maybe it's going in anyway, right?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, Kobayashi's header across a goal that he's stooped ahead in, just to make sure. I'm sure he told you, Kobayashi, afterwards. Damião, I mean, Sean Carroll mentioned last week that he didn't really see that much of him the previous Friday night. And in the first game as well against FC Tokyo, he was on the fringes. So basically he started and finished the game with goals here. What about in the meantime? Did he get himself more involved in general play than he had in the first two games?
No, but I don't think that's
necessarily
from what I
what they're
understand
after,
yeah, either what they're after and the player that he is. I mean, they already have a lot of creative players in and around that. I mean, you know, this game, you just imagine what was going through Manabu Saito's head, you know, after he left Marinos last year to come and be the pin-up boy at Frontale. It hasn't worked out for him. He couldn't even get off the bench, you know, in this kind of game where pretty much every Japanese club at least gives someone some kind of minutes against a former club. But, you know, that's the embarrassment of riches that... I mean, 2 years ago, so I'm not particularly a great fan of the guy, but he was being talked about, you know, as the next Japanese player to go to Europe, kind of a mainstay of the national squad. And, you know, now he can't kind of get minutes at all in this Frontale side. So they have across that, you know, the midfielder three, very, very, the advanced midfielder three, very, very exciting and creative players. So I think Damião was bought, as we said in preseason, to be that guy, to do what he did here, like two chances and scoring two goals. It's precisely the kind of player that they need. And I know also Sean, had a dissenting view last week about Kobayashi's best position, but I'm adamant that it's not up front. And I think that's been proven by the fact that, you know, they have this guy that can really, you know, score in little minor moments. And I think they were very, very unlucky, by the way, in the ACLs last week as well. They pretty much dominated most of that game and copped the late goal to lose there. So, you know, I hope that they can bounce back and do well in the ACL, because I think, you know, it's good that they're treating the competition seriously compared to our friends in the south or in the west, in Hiroshima, we're not doing so. So, this is why he was bought, I think, as much for the league as for the ACL. So, yeah, hopefully for their sake, that can all continue.
All right, a terrific occasion in the Kanagawa Derby, and as we said at the start, the spoils were shared on the afternoon. Also on Sunday... a game that, we had a personal stake in, Scott. FC Tokyo defeated Tosu 2-0 at home. And this was a collector's item because, as our mutual friend Alex Bishop let me know over the weekend, that Tokyo had not scored a home league goal since the start of August last year. They failed to score in all of their final six home games last season. So... and they almost made it seven here, of course, because they did not break the deadlock until poor old Hiromu Mitsumaru put through his own net in the 88th minute. So, yes, it literally was nearly seven full games between home league goals for FC Tokyo. But they enjoyed that one so much in the 88th minute that 5 minutes later they doubled their fun and Takefusa Kubo squared across the box for new Brazilian JL to poke home his first Tokyo goal in the 93rd minute and seal a 2-0 victory. And they did it playing against 10 men for the last half hour after Hideto Takahashi, of course, formerly of that parish, was sent off for two yellow cards that he collected in the space of 5 minutes. And, not a particularly successful homecoming for Hideto Takahashi. But, for Tokyo, that's two wins out of three, and they are unbeaten. For me, the first two games definitely were positive. This one, obviously, was a pretty hard watch at times, but they finally just about did enough to get over the line. How have you seen the start to the season for the Gasmen?
More positively generally than last season, but still with a lot of issues for what the club should be. I mean, this match was going to be 0-0, right? They could have played 527 minutes, I think, until the sending off of Takahashi, which really changed things. Whether it was you know, I mean, whether it mentally changed things for TOSU, because you've got to remember this is a TOSU club that's also really going in, what do you call it, like a DNA, you can't transplant DNA, can you? Or you can, I don't know, yeah, or DNA is just what you are.
Maybe you can.
So, so some kind of a spirit or a soul transplant, right? Because they've been this really dogmatic side for such a long time. They've joined the Spanish Revolution in bringing in Mr. Carreras, and it hasn't gone to plan. I think they've been playing certainly more positively than they have, but they've lost every game, I think, I'm right in saying, including in the Levain Cup as well. So you have to imagine that he's probably under a little bit of pressure, and at some point, you know, he's kind of alluded to that in his few post-match interviews as well, you know, that might start to show in the way that the team's performing. So I think, if it wasn't for Takahashi getting sent off, maybe this game also is going to be another one and keep that that record running. But you know, we look at the, you know, the investment that Corbe's doing. Gamba today just signed, you know, a young Spanish player also to come and join the party down there, and Tokyo, you know, signed this guy Arthur Silva. We still don't know if he's a proper footballer or not. He played a little bit in the J3, played in the cup. You know, you've got the other guy, the Korean boy Yu Insu, that you bought back from Fukuoka. So why again? For I understand it if it's a small club, but it's it's the only club in the top flight in the world's largest city. So I think they have to have a little bit more ambition. And while I think, generally speaking, the play's been more positive, the build-up has been more cohesive and coherent, I still don't think it's at the level where it should be. There are positives. Okay, it's great to see Kubo starting, and that particular battle with him on the right and young Matsuoka from TOSU on the left, who after the last league game, Carreras came out, was asked about him at the end of the match, and he specifically said, you remember this name, Daiki Matsuoka, because this guy should be in the next Japan squad. He's 17, and he's played his first minutes of senior football ever, wow, I believe. And the guy called for him to be called up to the March friendlies. So obviously his coach has got a huge rap on him. And, you know, and they actually had quite a few nice little jewels. There was one in the second half where Matsuoka kind of had the ball. He lost it, then Kubo got it and ran away. And he's kind of, you know, come up and bumped him off it. So, you know, it was great to see two kind of guys that, if you know, we know the hype about Kubo, but if we believe the hype coming from his own coach in TOSU, this Matsuoka is going to be an even better player. Then, you know, to see those two young bucks going at it was, probably the highlight of the game for me. That didn't really reach out any great heights until that send-off and then the late couple of goals.
All right, then. And, yes, I mentioned Hiromu Mitsumaru and his unfortunate own goal that, saw Tokyo take the lead. It was quite a weekend for own goals in the top flight and indeed in J2 as well, and quite an auspicious time for a new Twitter account to surface. At JOwnGoals tells you who scored an own goal in the J-League, because the J-League doesn't. It's it's an ingenious idea. I'm not completely sure who's behind it, but I believe that most of their tweets do come with, DAZN clips attached. So, quite an interesting new Twitter account for listeners to follow, to find out who really did score own goals in the J-League. That puzzling policy they have of just recording the goal as an own goal and not who scored it from the opposing team. Tokyo unbeaten after three games, and a little signs of progress, so we'll take that after the way last season finished. Let's do two games quickly here, Scott, because we want to come back to the Goal Fest at the Sapporo Dome on Saturday. There were first wins of the new J1 season for J1 powerhouses Kashima Antlers and Urawa Reds, the two teams who have won the ACL in back-to-back seasons. Of course, they both won 1-0 to claim their first victories. Akoki Anzai getting Antlers' winner just before the hour after a cross-in from Leo Silva from the right. And Reds' winner came from Shinzo Kuroki via the penalty spot after Matsumoto's captain, fantastic Yuya Hashiuchi, was penalised for handball. Very, very harsh of the referee, I felt, Scott, as Hashiuchi, as we all know, is very rarely in control of his extremities. But, yes, he was indeed penalised for blocking Kazuki Nagasawa's cross with his arm, and Kuroki made no mistake from the spot. So I'm sure there weren't any panic buttons being pressed either at the Kashima Soccer Stadium or Saitama Stadium, with the two J1 Giants failing to win in the first two match days. But they will be pleased nonetheless, I'm sure, after getting off to good ACL starts in the week to build on those over the past weekend.
I just wonder about Urawa. I mean, I think most people have them to you know, finish in their top four. Some people have them to win the whole thing, I think, as well.
They're literally still playing their preseason, aren't they?
Well, that's the thing. As I said to you last time, you know, because this thing with Oliveira saying we have to play 70 games, and so you can actually say that's true because they played one half-assed game in preseason, haven't done anything else. But the fact that they did win that first ACL game against a Buriram last week, I think, helps a lot. But this match was diabolical. I mean, it was absolutely snoozer-inducing stuff. I'm not quite sure if Matsumoto have what it takes to stay up, but Urawa were poor here again, as they've been poor all season. I think that he's trying to kind of somehow squeeze the new players into the setup, and I'm not totally sure it's working. Yamanaka, for some reason, didn't start here again. I'm not sure what's going on with Sugimoto. It appears now that he's been dropped, and Nabut looks to be the preferred option alongside Garoki. I'm not sure if the way that their setup is necessarily working for them either. And I just think that a club with this kind of expectation, I just wonder how much time they're going to give to Osvaldo Oliveira. I heard some kind of, you know, half whispers when there were just even a brief dip last year that they were looking to potentially move on, you know, to a different kind of coach. I imagine for Reds that the ACL is the real aim here. Of course, I don't want to totally struggle in the league, but it should really be all about getting as far as they can in the continental competition. I think if that starts to dip, then I don't know. Maybe we can start having discussions on perhaps. It seems strange, but maybe even Osvaldo being one of the first coaches to go. He's introducing new and kind of younger players into the squad. There we saw Kai Shibata here again, and saw a couple of other young guys impress, particularly off the bench in the ACL last week. But I'm just not sure that I'm just not sure it's totally clicking. I don't know if the players are. I don't know. I'm just speculating in terms of, you know, if they're totally on board with what's going on. He's an unusual kind of character. I know Osvaldo and have known him for a long time and like him very much. But, sometimes it can be hard to make his way work. And if the struggles continue, because, I mean, they were very, very fortunate to get away with a win here against a team that could likely be a contender to go straight back down to J2. So a win is a win, but okay, maybe for morale and some kind of, you know, points on the table, but I don't know if it's done much to allay any of the kind of fears that I had coming in to this game. Kashima have been, struck down by so much injury, and this was always the fear with them. I mean, after they played whatever it was, 50, 60 games last year, and somehow managed to stay intact mentally and more importantly, physically. And then right at the end of the season, you saw the players start to break down, right? Misao got injured, Yuma Suzuki got injured. And if you look through the squad at the start of this year, they're the headline guys that are out, although Misao's been back but hasn't got off the bench in the last couple of games. But if you look deeper into the squad, you know, young guy Oda is injured. The other backup right back is injured. The Yamamoto is injured. They've got a lot of depth options that are hurting as well, to the point where now they've only got one right back, and that's Uchida, who also seems to be forever injured. You know, they've basically converted a right winger in the young guy Hirato into a kind of makeshift right back. They might need to ask Uchida to back up in the ACL this week, a long trip away to China, and if he goes down, as we said pre-season, I think they're going to be in, you know, real kind of dire straits. Of course, Jung the Korean is the other one that's really, you know, being felt at his absence at the back as well. So I think if you put all the issues and the fact that they need to somehow, you know, rotate a little bit. We've seen Serginho have a rest in games. We've seen Endo coming in and out of the squad. So the squad is thin because of the players that are missing, and he needs to rotate within that. So I think the fact that, they're managing to scratch out, results, it's very unusual. The game that they played a couple of weeks ago against Kawasaki, I've almost never seen an Antlers team like this. You know, they had a point, and literally they tried to defend for the last 30 minutes to take results. So they're at that point. With the exhaustion, as I said, both I think physical and probably mental as well. So yeah, it's credit to the club that they're still managing to pick up points, pick up vital wins both in the league and in Asia. It wasn't attractive. I think, as I said, pre-season, Shonan have really been, I don't know, disappointing, because I think they're playing as I kind of expected them to. And I think that unless they make some kind of real serious adjustment mid-season, I think they're going to be very, very serious contenders for relegation. I'm not sure how our beer bet is going this early on in the season. What's the standing? Tosu are bottom by themselves on zero. That's not particularly impressive, but the Shonan are only the one win ahead of them, so yeah, long way to go before that beer's decided. But I'm more than prepared to back up that preseason claim that I think Tosu are going to finish ahead of them. And I think the rate that they're going, Bel Murray could really be added for the drop.
All right, Dan. Well, yes, the table doesn't lie, Scott, and Tosu the only team with nil points and nil goals scored. I'm not sure how you say that in French, but. Yeah, very early days, but yes, we shall see. Shonan, as I said last week, they were slightly disappointing, I felt, in their home game against Tokyo, but maybe Tokyo were pretty decent after all. But yeah.
The thing, Ben, they don't have one game changer, I don't think, in the entire squad. That's like a player, when you need a goal or you need a moment of inspiration, to chase things or to change the game. I don't think that player in the squad. I mean, this very bizarrely, the kind of, I don't want to say Dow, but somehow the steady left midfielder, Daiki Sukuoka, who is the oldest looking 21-year-old I've ever seen. He looks like about 50. And he's been held up as the kind of future for the clubs. I think that says a lot. I don't think the quality is there. And, if they have the money, then, they're a team that really needs to go out and sort it out mid-season.
Yeah, all right. Well, Taketomi the three goals he scored in the first two games, they might end up being the only three goals he scores all season. But, he could be, whether he's a difference maker in inverted commas, I'm not sure, but I think he's going to be a decent enough addition to that squad. But yeah, they are lacking serious quality, there's no doubt about that, but there's a lot of teams down there, I think, that are in a similar boat. But as I say, very early days, and we shall see. Let's finish off this part one of our J1 Match Day 3 review with the game that featured a quarter of the 28 goals scored in the match day. Sapporo 5, Shimizu 2. Musashi Suzuki started things off in the 19th minute. Komatsubara equalised for S-Pulse 9 minutes before half-time. And then, what else can you say, Scott, but Anderson Lopez took this game by the scruff of the neck and even jumping into a moat and almost breaking his leg did not break his stride. Either side of half time, he scored four goals in 20. How good's my math? It's 20, at least in 25 minutes. He's absolutely just run amok here. And the first one was a penalty, a fair dues, after Suzuki made a brilliant run into the box and was upended in the first half stoppage time. But then, he scored three after the break, and an absolutely phenomenal performance. As I say, jumping into the moat didn't bother him at all at the end of the day.
There were real fears for what happened, because it was a strange sign. I think he scored the goal and then the camera cut to a very unusual angle, a kind of wide shot, and there was a Shimizu player kind of hanging over one of the advertising boards. He didn't know what was going on, and then they've gone to the close-in shot. You seem like laying there on the ground. It's holy moly. It's like a 3-meter kind of drop from the top of this thing, and I've never seen anything like it, particularly it's his first game at home, but he's played in the league before, right? Or maybe they weren't in J1 at that time when he was with Hiroshima, I don't know. But you would have thought that he would have maybe had a training session or something, and he would have known what was going on. And he's just done that amazing leap, and it could have been it could have broken his arm. Look, I thought he dislocated his shoulder or something. They actually asked him about it at the end of the game as well, unusually for Japanese post-match interviews who tend to be purely focused on getting a public rousing for the fans. But they said, what did you think after you kind of fell into the thing? And he said, maybe it was, he laughed, and he said, maybe if it wasn't for falling there, I wouldn't have had the inspiration I needed to go on and get these other goals. So maybe he can do himself a number every second game at home. I don't know. Well, he was a very strange situation, but another really slick and clinical. I mean, yeah, obviously a fantastic individual performance, but I think also we talked pre-season. I kind of suggested that I wouldn't have been surprised if Masashi Suzuki had edged ahead of our mate Jay for that starting spot. It certainly looks like he has now, and he started this match, and Jay started the cup in the week. So I think perhaps the changing of the guard has come there, and he looks, I suppose, to be the first choice. Now, he was also very, very impressive in this game, as we should say Jay was in the cup midweek as well. So that's a delightful problem for Misha Petrovic to have to deal with. But, just another really impressive performance against a very disappointing Shimizu side. We talked about the first coach to be sacked. I'd hate it to be Jan Janssen, because I really enjoy his post-match interviews, although he's trimmed that in a little bit with this run that they're on. And I just wonder what's going on, because they made this decision with the squad that I didn't think it was built to do so, to revert to three central defenders and kind of wing backs at the start of the preseason. Really didn't work for them at all. They shifted back to a four in the cup midweek, and then went with a four here, which meant that this was the first game that Elsinho played. And he is essentially played as a right winger. I'm not sure that's his best position either. So they seemed to be caught between two ideas, a squad built for one system, and he was trying to force into another, and then reverting back and still forcing players into unfamiliar roles. And it just seems that the players are not particularly sure what's going on. And that's never a good sign. As has been said, they're clearly also missing Douglas. We don't know what's quite... this heart irregularity that he's dealing with. We don't know when he's expected back, but it's going to need to be quick, smart, because they're struggling mightily, and I think there seems to be a lot of confusion within the playing group, and the results are reflecting that. And I mean, they've been poor. There's no other way of saying it. They've been poor, and they look like they don't know what they're doing. So it's not it's not particularly happy days in that part of Shizuoka. Neither is it, mind you, at Jubilo either. Jeez, I'm sure you get onto that later as well, but they've been truly diabolical. Shimizu have probably been a little bit better, but they need to sort out the structural issues, kind of quick smart.
Yes, indeed. Both Shizuoka sides in the bottom four after three games. But just one more note or two on Anderson Lopez and his overall performance here. If you're interested in the Moat goal, in the 49th minute, he hooks home and jumps over the pitch side advertising hoardings, completely unaware that, as Scott mentioned, there's a 3-metre drop down to the concrete floor down below. Obviously, the Sapporo Dome, at least when it was finished around the time of the 2002 World Cup, very much a state-of-the-art stadium, with the football pitch being able to be basically grown outside and then moved in and out, and hovering around and all sorts. The stadium's also used for baseball. So around the side of the pitch there is a load of concrete, and Anderson Lopez wasn't aware of that for some reason. He jumped over the pitch side hoardings and landed flat on his ass on a big slab of concrete, and then he was able to dust himself off, and in the 65th minute dribbled from 25 yards inside his own half, beat pretty much the entire Shimizu side before finishing with his left foot. So, yes, it's the Moat goal in the 49th minute, and the solo Maisy dribble in the 65th is what you want to check out if you're looking at highlights of this particular game. And, Sapporo, after their opening day loss away at Shonan, well, that now looks a complete aberration, as they've won their last two in very impressive fashion. All right, we have briefly mentioned the ACL here with Scott, and in match day one last midweek, there were home wins, of course, for Kashima and Urawa, and away losses for Hiroshima and Kawasaki, but of course, that doesn't tell half the story. If you're interested in more about what happened in the ACL match day one, please check out Scott's podcast with Paul Williams, The Asian Game, the go-to podcast for anybody who's interested in Asian football. It is absolutely terrific. Very much an in-depth review of ACL match day one. Match day two takes place this midweek, and on Tuesday, Hiroshima will host Keisuke Honda and his Melbourne Victory side, while Kashima are away at Shandong Luneng, as Scott has mentioned. Then on Wednesday, Kawasaki host Australian opposition as well in Sydney FC, and Reds are also in China at Beijing Guowan. Is this going to be a weekly occurrence on the Asian game, Scott? You and Paul reviewing each ACL match day as they take place? Is that the intention?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
All right.
Not only that, you know, among other things, we had a chat with a Sri Lankan footballer last week, which is a place you don't get to hear much about. So trying to do, you know, the big end of town and the small one as well.
That's absolutely terrific, because I do tend to be quite half-assed when it comes to the ACL. So I will always steer my listeners in the Asian Games direction to get their ACL. Their proper ACL feed. It's very much appreciated.
There is a very unusual situation in this here Rushman game, because this is the return of Keisuke Honda, who's now at Melbourne Victory, the first time that he's played in Japan for a club side since he left Nagoya, I guess, more than a decade or so ago. And you would think it's a massive occasion, but for some bizarre reason in the latest catalogue of bizarre things done by the Asian Football Confederation, they've decided under tournament regulations to reduce the capacity at Erion to 11,000.
Because?
I have absolutely no idea. No idea at all why. I don't know. Maybe it's a corporate thing, or I don't know why. But all I know is that they've insisted that capacity is reduced down to 11,000 for the Champions League games. I'm not sure what the need for that is, because it's certainly not the case in the league, as we know. And yeah, those tickets apparently were sold out quite quickly. You know? So what could have been such a massive occasion for the club now is don't. I just don't get it anyway. The word on the street is that Hiroshima are going to trot out their B team again, as they did in China last week. You know, the tactical guru that is Hiroshi Jofuku has come up with this mastermind that's so deep and blessed with riches is his Hiroshima squad, that he's going to split them into two. He's going to have a league team for one thing and an ACL team for the other. So you imagine that that's not going to work. It's not going to work very well probably in either situation. But so it would be it'd be a really bad look. And as I said on the Asian Game podcast last week, I think this is something that the J League needs to look at, because what they're doing is, I mean, this is also the year we've got to remember when the realignment is happening. You know, the calculations and formulas that they use for awarding ACL places. So, you know, basically by Hiroshima trotting out, you know, a bunch of kids and a collection of older players on the down part of their career, they're hurting the chances of other Japanese clubs in the future. You know, I mean, there's a chance that Japan could lose a spot by, you know, how badly they've started, and they're likely to play, you know, with this ridiculous rotation policy. So it's not only hurting them in the immediate term, but it's hurting, you know, ambitious clubs. Imagine if you're a Kobe, right? You spend all this money, slogans to be the bloody world number one team in Asia, and you might not be able to get into the tournament this year because Hiroshima down the road have gone and, you know, played their kids in the competition. So this is something that, you know, really, if I was running the J League, I'd be having very stern words with Hiroshima and saying, you know, look, try and sort it out.
Yes, indeed. And to get to Scott's full thoughts on the debacle of Hiroshima in the ACL, once again, I'll point you in the direction of the excellent Asian Game podcast, the terrific work by Scott and Paul Williams. Absolutely terrific stuff. All right, Scott, well, thanks very much for sharing your thoughts on, five of the games from J1 Match Day 3. Very much appreciated as usual. And I hope to speak to you again soon.
Likewise.
All right. Thanks again to Scott McIntyre. I'll be back in a moment with Alan Gibson.
Since 1998, Lanco Group has been providing superior civil engineering solutions and advice to developers, local government and service authorities across Australia. Lanco Group is known for delivering sustainable, efficient solutions. By working closely with clients, Lanco Group is able to meet the complex infrastructure requirements for residential, commercial, and industrial developments on time, on budget. Find out more at lancogroup.com.au. Lanco Group, your business partner for engineering solutions.
It's a big welcome back to J Talk to Alan Gibson. Alan, how are you?
Woo! Welcome back!
Yeah, I'm fine, thank you. It's a new season. I'm a very happy person.
That's great. Good to hear. Of course, as usual, when we have you on, the focus will be on the three Kansai clubs. Mixed results for them in match day 3. And before we finish, we also want to touch on a second win of the new season for Oita Trinita. Not quite in your sphere of influence, Alan, but definitely qualifying as a West team, or as Scott tried to pick me up at the start of part one, a South team, of course. But yes, that doesn't really count in our East versus West format here. But, yeah, let's just start with the two Osaka clubs. They both fell to odd goal home defeats on Saturday. We'll begin with Gamba, the highest scoring of the two games. Late heartbreak for Gamba after an 87th minute Hiroki Fujiharu own goal saw Nagoya take the lead for the third time in this game. And yes, it was that late that they were able to claim all 3 points. Gamba fighting back from a goal down, as I said, on two separate occasions. But then, it was too late after Fujiharu's own goal. So this is now two home defeats from three games for Gamba, and they've come to two of the teams currently sitting in the top three. So I guess if you look at it from that aspect, it hasn't been the worst start. But, they will have been frustrated after, as I say, after pegging Grampus back twice here to not to go on and to take anything from the game.
Indeed. As you say, are they the top two or FC Tokyo up there as well?
Two of the top three, I think I said.
Yeah. So, as you said, looking at it that way, it's not so bad for Gamba, but I'm not sure those two are going to be there at the end of the season, nor even in 10 or 15 games. But, no, Gamba were okay. They seem to have settled on, a side that, I think I would say that this is as close to full strength as Gamba are going to get. No injuries. Kono's back. He wasn't 100% in the starting game, but he's good. I think the key player is going to be centre back Kim Young Gong, who's not quite as good as I'd hoped yet. But I guess he's got to settle in. But Gamba's defence is the problem. I mean, a bit like I guess F. Marinos and Grampus even. Grampus attacked well from the start. They scored in about 35 or 40 seconds. But Gamba had plenty of opportunities, plenty of attacks. Both goalkeepers made some great saves. Endo, interestingly enough, played about three or four passes. It was like, what's going on with that man there? And then he just came good in the second half. But Endo was as excellent as ever. But it was Yajima is going to be the substitute, I guess. Yajima and Ko. So I'm rambling a bit, but they've got a decent squad. Yajima, Ko, Tanaka's coming, of course. And Kazuma Watanabe is a decent sub. So Gamba have a decent squad. They've got a decent attack. I mean, I think what they scored, but 1, 2, 3, they've scored a few goals. But they're letting them in. So if Kim can settle in and they can stay without some injuries, it's going to be an interesting season. I think Gamba can turn it around eventually.
All right. Well, yeah, not surprising. Gamba have scored the second most goals in the league, but conceded the second most as well after three games. So, never a dull moment at the Suita Stadium. So, yeah, you mentioned the very early goal for Grampus. That came from Shuhei Akasaki, who, of course, built off his brace in the last game. Then the Grampus defender, Shinosuke Nakatani, was... he didn't have the best of afternoons. He slid in to score an own goal in the 36th minute. And then after Yao Schmidt had headed in to give Grampus the lead again at 2-1, and Nakatani then fouled Adamilson inside the box, and the Brazilian stepped up to convert the penalty with just over 20 minutes to go. But yes, as we've mentioned, Fujiharu, unfortunately, he didn't know anything about it, but Masaaki Higashiguchi touched Yuki Soma's low cross in off the defender, and that was the 3 points for Grampus, and making them the only side to be a perfect three wins from three after three match days, and they sit 2 points clear of FC Tokyo and Yokohama. That was definitely an entertaining game at the Suita City Stadium, Alan, but yes, slightly less attractive on the eye was a Cerezo Osaka and their home game against Hiroshima. Of course, numerous guests on this podcast were well and truly on the record, and I think yourself included, Alan, about the way Hiroshima go about things. But they were able to notch a first win of 2019, joining Kashima and Reds in that boat by winning 1-0 at Cerezo, thanks to Emil Salomonsson's 19th-minute goal. He did not... give up on a dead end. And, yeah, he deserves enormous credit for chasing down a poor Cerezo back pass. And, yeah, after a bit of a scramble, nicking the ball off Mate Jonic and, yeah, sweeping home. So that was it for Hiroshima. That was all they needed, despite Cerezo dominating possession. And, yeah, I don't know, bit of a nothing game, Alan. Not a lot to say from it. Hiroshima will obviously be very happy to get the 3 points. And Cerezo, just yet another frustrating afternoon for them.
Well, I think there's one point, as in one thing to talk about for each team, I reckon. And for San Fricci, it's Salomonsen. He's playing as a right wing back. He can also play as a right back. But when I was in Thailand pre-season tour and I watched Sanfrecce, and they were, you'd be surprised to hear that they were quite dire against the Chonburi. They lost 2-1. But Salomonsen, I think I was tweeting back then, who's this guy and why is he playing centre forward? he was caught offside 2 or 3 times. He had one shot where he was literally in the centre forward position and he shot wide. And I'm thinking, like, this guy's well, he's the only bright spark they have, because he was everywhere on the pitch. And the fact is that he is a right wing back. And where he was to create that goal was basically the centre forward position.
Yeah.
He was the guy who was doing what the likes of Patrick or Douglas Vieira or whoever should be doing, pushing the defence into making mistakes. And then he went in there, he slid in, he grabbed the ball. It was a bit of a mess, but he carried on and he slotted it home. He's going to be the bright spark for Sanfrecce this year. I liked him a lot when I saw him pre-season, and I like him. And that volley, was it a volley? A bouncing goal. That shot he scored last game or the game before. They all blend into each other.
Yeah,
he scored
in the first round. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, he scored an amazing goal there as well. He's definitely a good pickup, isn't he? So I like him a lot, but I'm not sure about the rest of the team. Cerezo, I'm not sure what's going on there. They bought Ken Tokura and then they stick him on the bench. And then they put Souza. Well, apparently he was playing up front, but he wasn't really. It was more of a 3-4-2-1, the Christmas tree formation, I think you might call it. But Souza was replaced about around the hour mark by Tokura, and he came on and started causing a bit of offence, which was nice. I'm not sure as what Takura's done to upset anyone. In the Vissel Kobe game, in the first game of the season too, Vissel were absolutely all over Cerezo Osaka. They just didn't score a goal. And then Tokura came on, again, I don't know, 65 minutes or so, and immediately had a couple of chances. Cerezo changed it. They started putting a few long balls up there. He gets in there with his elbows and pushing people around. He created chances. And they scored, albeit from a corner. But I'm not sure what Cerezo are doing with Tokura on the bench. He should be starting every game for me.
All right. So, yeah, the two Osaka clubs did not have a particularly good time of it this weekend. But the third team in the Kansai region, Kobe, well, they headed on their travels up to Sendai and came back with a 3-1 victory and therefore all 3 points. They came from behind as well after new Mozambican player Simao Mate opened the scoring for Sendai in just the 12th minute, heading home from a corner. But then, Kyogo Furuhashi made it to 1-1 just past the half hour. Andres Iniesta's chipped cross from inside the box, headed home at close range by Furuhashi. Then almost straight from second half kickoff, Alan, David Villa made it to 2-2 for him. And that's got to be very pleasing for, the head honchos at Kobe, of course, who have pumped a lot of money into him. I mean, this is pleasing a lot of people, of course, DAZN and Vija himself, obviously, has made a positive impact after, I guess a lot of people probably expecting him to score in every game. Of course, he didn't in the first match day. And, Sam Robson was saying he was played out of position. Well, the last two games, he's been stuck up front. And there you go, 2-2.
He's excellent. He's wonderful. He's a credit to people our age, shall I say. he's definitely, he's not past it. Playing out of position against Cerezo on the left wing, he was taking on 3 or 4 defenders at a time and putting the balls across, but there was just no one there to finish. Tellingly, Furuhashi is the man I think should be there to finish, and wasn't in that game. He came back, and he had a wonderful game. I think he pretty much created the first goal, and then got on the end of it again. A nice near post header from Iniesta's little cross there, which was nice, and then he scored that one, and he gave Vija the pass for the second. And I think Vissel really could have had so many goals in that game, to be honest. As you say, DAZN and Vissel Kobe, of course, will be very happy. I think there was one literally 10 or 15 seconds spot where I think Vija had a shot blocked. It fell to Podolski, who then had that blocked, and then it fell to Iniesta, who shot wide. It was like, perfect. Those three guys getting a shot in 15 seconds. They should use that in the highlights. But for me, Furuhashi's, in fact, I'm wearing a Furuhashi shirt now. Coincidentally, I'm wearing my Vissel Kobe number 16. And I really like the boy, as I think I've probably said it three or four times on various podcasts over the last year, I suppose. But Vissel, they're going to be, as I said, I think at the start of the season, Vissel are going to be everybody's club final. They're going to be everybody's hated team. Fans will be jealous of all the money they're spending. And I'm not sure I like it myself that much. But and of course, they bought in a new guy, Sergi Samper. You might talk about him in a moment. But as long as they find space for a young player like Furuhashi, and in fact, talking of him, will Moriyasu find space for him in the Kirin Cup coming up? I think the manager, Mr. Lillo, whatever you want to call him, is... He's got a job ahead of him, but so far Vissel look very, very good on the ball. They're tiki-taka. They're playing this false nine thing. 4-3-3 usually, although it looked more like 4-2-3-1 on the weekend. But the fact is that the players seem to be flexible in their positions. They're all running. They're all working. Even Podolski's working up and down a little bit, but could do harder. But, I think they're looking good. I was trying to, as I said, hold back judgment, and everybody's going to think they're going to win everything this year. I was expecting that they're probably not going to win anything this year, but Mkhitaryan has to be patient, let them build, let them finish top three or four, and then maybe next year win something. But to be honest, from what I've seen, the way they're playing, the bad luck in the Cerezo game, to be honest, and they come over that with two wins, I think Vissel could win something this year. Put me on record.
All right, yeah, fair enough. I mean, that's a good win, a second straight win this time away at the Sendai on Sunday. And yes, the third goal was an own goal scored by Vegalta defender Kazuki Oiwa, as we mentioned earlier with Scott. Yes, a good weekend debut for the new Twitter account at J Own Goals, and yes, Oiwa's added to the collection there. On Sunday, so yes, Kobe, as we said, two wins from two straight wins coming after their disappointing opening day loss away at Cerezo Osaka. So yeah, Kobe heading in the right direction, and that's good to see. A lot invested, of course, in the squad, and I mean the main man Iniesta was involved in all three goals, of course. So yeah, the cross for Furuhashi's first, then he released Furuhashi down the left for him to cross for Vija for the second, pretty much straight from the second half kickoff. And then Iniesta played in Lucas Podolski, whose attempted squared ball across the box was basically deflected into his own net by Oiwa. So, yeah, a good return for Kobe. And I mentioned earlier, Alan, that, yeah, we wanted to get your thoughts on Oita. Scott mentioned them ever so briefly in part one. But, yes, they've made it two wins from three. Both away from home, of course, in their J1 return. Their latest was a 2-1 win away at Jubilo Iwata, which is not the meanest feat. Of course, after they won, after they shocked the entire J-League by winning at defending Asian champions Kashima in match day one, we thought they might have been brought back to earth a little bit by losing at home against fellow promoter team Matsumoto in their home opener. But, yes, another attractive display by Trinita on the road. I'm tempted to say these are 3 points that, you know, could prove telling at the end of the season, Alan. But, I mean, if they keep putting in decent performances like this, then, I mean, relegation won't be a trouble for them at all.
Indeed. I expected, looking at the fixtures, I expected them to have two wins by now, but Not against Antlers. I thought they'd beat Matsumoto, to be honest. But they've got the two wins. They don't seem to. They look as if they're approaching the games with nothing to lose, and everybody's expecting them to be relegated. I expect. They're fresh. They're fast. They break well. They've got some good players. Yusuke Goto was really good last year, and of course he did extremely well at the weekend. Fujimoto, what a volley that was for the first goal. And in fact, Goto's volley for the second goal too. I mean, those two players, Titipan, the Thai guy playing in the midfield, got in a nice shot early in the first half and did a lot of good work. They have some quite decent players, two of which I know from Vissel Kobe, Ryosuke Maeda and Seigo Kobayashi. So I've been watching those a little bit too. And Mr. Kenji Baba, who's not even on the bench this time, but he's a very, very good, shall we say, a club player. Has been a friend of mine for a long time. We used to play for Vissel Kobe long ago, and I think he was about 19 or 20. I saw him walking down the street once wearing a shirt said, "I make good babies."
Right.
So I had to explain what that meant to him, and I don't think he wore it again. So very Japanglish, whatever they call that. But yeah, I mean, Oita, they look wonderful. Goto, maybe we should say that they didn't look that wonderful, but Jubilo just looked dire. The space given to Goto down the right when he made the run, and then Fujimoto was just allowed to run free down the middle, and his volley at the near post was brilliant. And then Fujimoto was free again with a through pass on the half-hour mark when Takuma Ominami got the red card, which I don't think really affected the game much. I mean, Jubilo was so bad. And what I really liked was the fact that Fujimoto, I mean, Ominami came up behind him. He grabbed him, he pulled his shirt, he put his arm around him. And Fujimoto kept going for about another 10 yards before Ominami finally dragged him down and got the red card. A lot of players would have just gone down immediately, but Fujimoto just wanted to get through and score a goal, I think. So I did like that. Jubilo, if we can talk about Jubilo,
please.
They were very quiet in the transfer market. I've seen literally four or five new players and about seven or eight gone. I mean, they were, compared to someone like Belmara, for example, who had about 20 in and 20 out, Jubilo had very little movement for a team that struggled and only managed to stay in the division on the playoffs. I was surprised about that. They did get Adalton and Musayev back. Adalton, of course, scored his goal. They both missed virtually the whole of last season, so it's like having two players, two brand new players. But I'm not sure that they have enough. There's not enough change in that team to get over the fact that they struggled so badly last season. So I think it's very much they're just going to continue where they are. And if Oita and other teams around them can get points against the likes of Jubilo and, as we've seen, the dire Sagan Tosu, then teams like Trinita and Matsumoto may well be safe.
Yeah, it was really, really puzzling, wasn't it, that they didn't want to freshen things up after such a narrow escape. Yeah, I mean, having to play the promotion relegation playoff against the J2 playoff winner, Tokyo Verde, last year, and yet to just sit on their hands in the winter transfer window, was it really puzzling? And I mean, yeah, I guess, you get what you paid for. And in this case, yeah, Jubilo, they eked out two draws in the first two match days. But yes, they were given their comeuppance by Oita on Saturday. And yes, good luck to Trinita. They're sixth in the table, very early days, of course. But I mean, as I said, 6 points that they have in the bank, and some of the teams that they might be battling relegation with later on in the season, yeah, they don't have that many yet. So, every little counts. And Trinita, but as we said, I mean, if they keep on playing like this, as I said, they might not have to worry about relegation at all. All right, well, they are all nine games of J1 Match Day 3 rounded up then. And we've mentioned with Scott at the end of our part one of our J1 roundup about the ACL coming this midweek. So let's very briefly with Alan look ahead to next weekend and J1 Match Day 4. All games will be played on Sunday. And it's a very strange quirk in the schedule that obviously nobody could have seen coming, Alan. But Kobe in fifth hosting Shimizu in 17th is the only game on the slate of teams in different halves of the table. It's just worked out that after three match days and the way all these teams are aligned in the table, that, yeah, four of the games feature teams in the top half and four of them feature teams in the bottom half. I guess the pick of them, and it has to be because it's the top two, is FC Tokyo, currently second, hosting the only perfect team after three games, Nagoya at Ajinomoto Stadium. That's a 1:30 kickoff. Then at 2 o'clock, Sapporo, fresh off their 5-2 hammering of Shimizu, host Kashima. And the other game I flagged, Alan, was the recently mentioned Oita, currently sixth, as we said, hosting third-placed Yokohama. That's, yeah, I mean, that could be anything. If Oita play as attractively as they have in their two away games so far, if they can take that form to their home stadium and try and play like that against Yokohama, well, that game could be absolutely anything. Are there any of those games that you want to pick up on, or any other games you'd like to mention that look noteworthy for you?
I think I like the look of that one. It's it'll be interesting to see if, I think, F. Marinos so far, I mean, they surprised Gamba with the intensity in the first game, looking closely at it. And, of course, from a blue and black spectacle point of view, Gamba could have won that game. But Marinos scored more goals, state the obvious. But they were so intense. But Ikura and his defence made an error, just like they did, you know, this weekend also. They conceded. How many goals have the Marinos conceded? Is it five already?
That's right.
It's going to be an incredible season again. I mean, last year I think they scored about 50 and conceded 51, something like that. And I feel it's going to be the same this year. And once teams realise how they play, poor Gamba got stuck right in the first game. But it's going to be interesting to see a team like Oita, who've got fresh players and enthusiasm and some youngsters in there, how they're going to approach it, because now that people have seen how Marinos play, it's going to be a little bit harder. And pressure on that defence already. They conceded a goal again this week, a bit of a mix-up again. So I quite fancy Oita I could probably score against F. Marinos, but I think that Marinos will take it against Oita this time. But I don't know, Sanfrecce Yamaga seems likely, because Matsumoto have some great away support and Sanfrecce seemingly dire, right? So I think Yamaga might get another win there, which is going to be very useful in the future. Kawasaki Frontale against Gamba and Consadole against Antlers. Both of those teams will be coming back off a ACL game. So, and Antlers have got so many injuries, it's ridiculous. You know, I mean, I've got like backup defenders are injured, and Jung Sung-hyun, the centre back, is apparently suffering from fatigue and not being considered, but we shall see. Shuto Yamamoto at left back, Ito Yukitoshi's out for months because of an injury. Nakamura's gone, and of course Suzuki Yuma, they thought he was coming back and he had a hamstring relapse. I mean, they've got about five or six first 15 or players, shall we say, injured. And they're going up against Consadole, who've got the, you know, scoring those goals. We should give a mention to Mr. Anderson Lopez and his high jump. Did you mention that already with Scott?
Most definitely, yes.
It's made all the papers and all the websites all over the world, hasn't it? So I think Consadole will be looking for goals, but in that one, Antlers are the experts at doing as little as possible, as little as needed, conserving energy, keeping a tight defence, and drawing 0-0 or even winning 1-0, like they did this weekend. The ACL game will be over, so they don't have to worry about that. This weekend, I think they were concentrating on the ACL and still managed to eke out the 1-0 win. I think Endo, Serginho, Misao, Kenta were all on the bench resting, even though they have so many injuries. So Consadole might be on a high, and I really do like them. When they play Musashi Suzuki's doing extremely well as well, isn't he? So I think that could be the game for me to watch. Even though it might end up 0-0 or 1-0 to either team, the purist might like it. But I don't see many goals, but that's probably the game for me. As an FC Tokyo fan, I'm putting you on the spot there. What do you think? Do they deserve to be up in second, and are they good enough to keep it up?
Well, very early doors, but I was very pleased with the opening day draw away at Kawasaki, and yeah, pleasantly surprised by the away win at Shonan in match day two. We definitely made hard work of squeaking past Tosu this past Sunday, and yeah, it took a Hideto Takashi red card to give us that impetus to go on and take the game. I mean, it took us half an hour after he got sent off before we finally were able to get the first goal, which was, of course, a known goal as well. But, for me, positive signs. I mean, the way we finished last season was absolutely dreadful, and I don't think I actually verbalised this to anybody, but I was kind of having inklings that we might be in a spot of relegation trouble, because it looked like we were just spiralling out of control the second half of last season. But things seem to have steadied somewhat in the off season, and a positive start, an unbeaten start to the season. I'm not sure I have a lot of confidence that we can we'll be able to say that we're still unbeaten after Sunday, because Nagoya do look pretty decent. But from the way we finished last season, I'm definitely a lot more positive now than I was then.
Did the 628 minutes without the home goal get a mention, Lee Scott?
Well, not the exact number, but yes, I did realise it was almost seven full games until, the own goal did us a huge favour. But, I'd lost track towards the end of last season. But as I said in part one, Alex Bishop had let me know that it was an extra long drought, and it was very, very pleased and relieved to finally see it end, of course.
And you gave Alex a mention, which is what I was doing. So nice one, Alex. Thank you for that.
Nice.
The hoodoo's done, the own goal, and then the first goal for a new boy, JL, is that what you pronounce
it? That's right, yes, indeed, yeah.
So, good luck to you, sir.
Thank you very much. Yes, it'll be a tall order against the Grampus in the last match day before we take a short break for the internationals the following week. Match day four coming up this Sunday in J1. So, Alan, thank you very much for your time in rounding up the rest of match day three. And, look forward to catching up with you again soon.
It's always a pleasure to talk about the game I love. Thanks a lot for having me on.
All right, thanks again to Alan Gibson. J2 is next with John Steele.
Since 1998, Lanco Group has been providing superior civil engineering solutions and advice to developers, local government and service authorities across Australia. Lanco Group is known for delivering sustainable, efficient solutions. By working closely with clients, Lanco Group is able to meet the complex infrastructure requirements for residential, commercial, and industrial developments on time, on budget. Find out more at lancogroup.com.au. Lanco Group, your business partner for engineering solutions.
And we finish off this week's episode with a check on match day three in J2. For that, it's my pleasure to welcome John Steele back to the pod. John, how are you?
Hi, Ben. It's nice to be back. Hope everyone's enjoying the season so far.
Yes, J2 is rolling on galactically, John. We have three teams, a perfect three wins from three games, and they're obviously the same three teams that we were talking about last week with Charlie Houghton. So, yes, that means that Ryukyu and Mito have carried on their merry ways. Ryukyu top after a 2-0 home win over Ehime FC. Just the one goal this week for Koji Suzuki, John. He went easy on Ehime FC, obviously, after starting the season with a pair of braces, while Mito won 1-0 away at Nagasaki. And as the listeners will discover throughout this part of the podcast, 1-0 away was definitely the scoreline du jour of J2 match day three. So, briefly, the two surprise packets at the top of the table. What have you seen from them, firstly, on this weekend, but, in their three games thus far?
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that we probably weren't expecting to be talking about FC Riku and Mito Hollyhock, at the top of the table after three rounds. And I'm sure quite a few of their fans have got maybe, photos of the league table saved, on screen saves and things, just as a memento in case things go south from here on in. But I think for Riku, from what I've seen so far, it's definitely a case that they've got that momentum from winning the J3 title last year. It doesn't seem to have fazed them stepping up to a higher level. And in Koji Suzuki, as you already mentioned, I think they've got a player who is proven box office goal scorer at J2 level. I'm still scratching my head as to why Machida Zelvia allowed him to leave in the winter transfer window and join Riku. I'm not sure whether that was a contract issue or maybe he just wanted a change of scenery. But it's funny, I don't know whether it's that very nice kind of maroon shirt that Riku have as their home colours, but he just seems, just seeing him in the highlights from the game this weekend, seems a bit leaner, maybe a bit fitter than he was in the last season or so at Machida. And yeah, to see him among the goals is no surprise. Three straight wins for them is great, and I think the fact as well that they've scored 9 goals. And early on in the season, sometimes teams have, as you mentioned, they've won games 1-0 and the goal difference isn't that impressive. But to have scored 9 already, I don't think we're going to see Riku struggling at the wrong end of the table this year. For Mito, they do have a habit of doing this from time to time, of having a good start or having a good run of results, and they can sort of lull you into a full sense of security now and again. But I think, again, the fact they've had such a strong start will mean that they will probably steer clear of any relegation worries. And, they haven't scored as many as Riku, obviously, with 5, but they haven't conceded at all. I think they're the only team now with, 3 consecutive shutouts. So they must be doing something, right? They might hang around at the top for a while.
Yeah, great stuff from both Riku and Mito. Surprise packets, as we mentioned. But as we've said so far, Kashiwa Reysol, definitely not a surprise to see them up towards the top of the table. And, yes, they made it 3 wins from 3 with a 1-0 away win at Niigata. And credit to the supporters of both clubs for getting to the Big Swan in droves. Just over 20,000 there, John, to create a terrific atmosphere. Obviously, Niigata, after a disappointing season last year, they want to be up towards the sharp end of the J2 table this year. A big effort from their supporters to make it out to the stadium. But yes, it ended in a disappointment after Michael Olunga's 73rd minute goal. The Chiba Sun Kings, Kashiwa Reysol, most people are tipping them to go straight back up. This loomed as a decent early test for them. And they certainly haven't blown Albirex away, but to return with 3 points will be a very pleasing for the Reysol faithful.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Obviously, Niigata away isn't the easiest looking fixture on paper. I think you're right to say Niigata probably disappointed their fans for a few seasons in a row. So it's quite good to see that they're still, supporting the team and even following the team in big numbers. I know Niigata are playing away at Yokohama FC this weekend, and the tickets for the away section behind the goal at Mitsuzawa already sold out. So, Niigata fans do travel in big numbers as well as going to the home games. That's good for the league in general. And I think this game, from what I could tell, was probably heading to a nil-nil stalemate until some pretty ropey defending presented Olunga with that chance, which he put away very well. I think, sorry to bring this up, I think he scored 2 against FC Tokyo in the Levan Cup as well the previous midweek. So,
did the Levan Cup start last week, John? I hadn't realised.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah, I thought I'd just throw that in there.
Okay.
So I believe he seems to be... I don't think Reysol have exactly blown anyone's socks off with the results they've had so far. I know it's 3 straight wins, but I don't think they haven't pile-driven anybody off the pitch. But, they're ticking along nicely, and I think, whereas it's probably fair to say we expect Riku and Mito to maybe slip down the table as the match days pile on, I think Reysol more likely to be travelling in an upward direction.
OK, so they are the 3 teams, a perfect 3 wins from 3 games. Next, we come on to the other two unbeaten teams who sit with two wins and a draw from three games. And you guessed it, they both won 1-0 away in match day three. Kofu returned from Kagoshima with a 1-0 victory thanks to Shohei Ogura. And Kyoto, somewhat of a surprise packet up in the top six after three games, won 1-0 away over Fukuoka. And week on week, John, my prediction of a Fukuoka in the playoffs just looks dafter and dafter. They just, they cannot buy any sort of result at all, Avispa. And, Kyoto getting the 3 points thanks to Kyohei Kuroki. Kofu obviously were considered to be a decent shout for at least a playoff place, John, this season after they've reinforced in the winter. But, Kyoto getting off to a somewhat surprising early start.
Yeah, I think we, thinking back to our sort of season preview pod with Stuart a month or so ago, and I think we were kind of in agreement that Kyoto would do better than last season, but I think they were pretty abject for most of 2018, and I think in a stronger season for J2, they might even have been in danger of finishing in the bottom two and being relegated. It really was that bad. Yeah, to see them making such a strong start this year is good news all round. And it was a really well worked goal that got them all 3 points for the weekend. So it's not that they are fluking goals or fluking wins, and they're playing some pretty tidy football into the bargain. So I hope they can maintain that. It would be great, I think, to see them maintain that. I don't know, maybe it's just me for some reason. I do see them as being one of the bigger clubs, even though they've kind of been at the wrong end of the table for a few seasons in a row. So it'd be good to see them making a bit of a challenge this year. I know they've got the sort of brand spanking new stadium to come, I think, as well, haven't they, next year? So it would be nice to, it would be fantastic if that's, they're welcoming in a J1 season at that new stadium. I think that's perhaps jumping the shark a little bit, but if at least they've got a strong team to sort of bed into the new stadium, that would be good news. And yeah, for Kofu, I don't really have much to add to what Stuart said back in that preview pod. They've brought in good players, and they're another team that underachieved a little bit last year, although they very narrowly missed out on the playoffs in the end. So I think, again, similar to Kashiwa Reysol, I expect to see them around that top six and possibly pushing, for the top two as the rounds go on and we get towards Golden Week, I think.
All right, then. So next we have four teams who won for the first time in 2019. Two of them 1-0 away from home, if you don't mind. They were Omiya Ardija winning 1-0 away at Tokushima thanks to David Babunski, and Yokohama FC left it very, very late to beat Tochigi SC. Akira Toshima's 93rd minute goal saw YFC claim their first win of the season. Also, friend of the podcast Gary White was able to celebrate a first victory as a Tokyo Verde boss. His Greens won 2-1 at home over Kanazawa thanks to a Ryohei Hayashi brace. And just bear with me for a second here, John, as I have to offer a big mea culpa to Genki Yamada, the Yamaguchi goalkeeper. Both Charlie Houghton and myself ripped him to shreds last week for his nightmare performance in last week's 5-2 home loss against Kofu, and I suggested he might never be picked for the club again. Well, this week he got to watch five goals go in at the other end and only let in two himself as his Renofa side got their first win of 2019, a 5-2 away at Chiba, a later Kazuma Takai brace sealing victory for Yamaguchi after Jeff had reduced their deficit to 3-2 with 20 minutes left. So, the first three first winners I mentioned there, John, obviously all Kanto clubs, Omiya, Verde, and Yokohama FC, and Yamaguchi beating another Kanto club, Chiba, who sit at rock bottom after three games. So I'm going to leave those four games at your feet and let you decide what you want to do with any or all of them?
Yeah, I think as I'm speaking to an FC Tokyo supporter, I think you'll agree with me that the first win of the season is always extremely important. You know, you want to get off the mark as early as possible with 3 points. So I think Omiya, obviously, one of the teams that have had to wait until the third game to do that. But obviously, winning away at Tokushima is a great result. They're a team that we're expecting to be strong this year. And it was a really well-taken goal as well by Babinski. So that will give him confidence. And maybe, I'm not sure if he's starting regularly, but I think that will obviously give Takuya Takagi some food for thought in terms of, you know, the forward positions. I think what will please Gary White most about the Verdy victory is that they had to come from behind to do it. Obviously, they let in a pretty soft goal in about the 8th minute, I think, in the first half. So it's always a sign of a character when teams can turn that around. And at Ryohei Hayashi, I don't think he was a first-choice forward back in round one. When Verdy lost away at Machida, the preferred front two was Leandro and the new guy Nemanja Kojic. So it'd be interesting, you know, Hayashi getting that brace. It might put him in the frame that I think you're inclined to believe he'd probably start the next game now. He seems to be in form. Second goal was very fortuitous, though. I don't know if you've seen the highlights, but talking about goalkeeper kerfuffles, the keeper just came out, slid out to collect a low cross and just fumbled it or let it go, and it just kind of plopped onto Hayashi's leg and went in. So it was a fortunate winner, but again, it's the first win of the season, so I don't think anyone really minds. Yokohama FC, similar story. I think obviously a late goal from as a lot of matches Elvia fans used to call him, low energy Toshima. It was a nice left foot finish. He still had the energy to do that right at the end, so it's a good win for them. And Jeff, I don't know what to say. But congratulations to Yamaguchi. I think for Jeff fans, they might say they had Yuki Horigomi. He was sent off only in about the 15th minute for a pretty stupid tackle in that game. So Jeff played, you know, 75 minutes with 10 men. Although from the highlights that I saw, they looked like they were playing with about 8 men, to be honest. And I'm not really sure where they go from here. I think they lost, was it 4-1? Or was it, they let in 4 at home against Niigata, didn't they, the week before? And I was reading on Twitter that some fans accosted the team boss after the game, after the Niigata game, to kind of let the players know what they thought of their efforts. And someone on some Jeff on Twitter had commented, well, that's not really good behaviour. And someone else commented and said, well, if you're not going to surround the team bus after a game like that, when are you going to do it? And I think the answer would probably be in the very next home game if the performance is even worse. So, the locals, you know, the natives pretty restless, I think, at Jeff at the moment. And, they need to... I've just been talking about how important it is for teams to get the first win. I think Jeff fans would just like to see just a competent... If they can just put a competent 10 minutes of football together, I think that'd give them a platform at the moment. Yeah, pretty awful start to the season for them.
Yeah, well, baby steps. Yeah, 10 minutes at a time. That's some way to get going.
If you haven't seen it, the goals that Jeff conceded. I mean, we're an audio only presentation here, and the goal, the defending just defies description, really. Particularly the last one where. Jeff is supposed to have a 4-man defence, and there's 3 defenders in the picture. 2 of them are standing completely still. 1 of them is appealing for offside, but the other one that's completely still is about 5 yards behind him, playing everybody onside. The third defender, who's between the two of them, is frantically chasing the forward who's just gone clean through. And it's like, I mean, if I was the manager, I wouldn't know where to start with, like... Everyone's in the wrong position, but I wouldn't be able to work out who has started this wrong, who is the most wrong, you know, who would need the most kind of corrective feedback. It just really is that. It's just a real surprise that Juan Schneider was, the manager had his contract renewed for another season, because I don't think, you know, obviously last season wasn't a particularly impressive one, and I think he really needs... Yeah, it sounds like it really is baby steps, but if it just a positive from somewhere, you know, to get the season kick-started would be very welcome, I think.
Yeah, not the start Jeff supporters were looking for, but still a long way to go, of course, in J2. And, one little spark, one lucky break can spark a run of results. So that's always possible in J2, as we know. Anything in the most unpredictable league in the world is well and truly possible. And there we go, John. All of a sudden, we find ourselves with the only two games left to cover, and they were won by the teams who finished the match day in sixth and seventh. Yamagata won 3-0 away at Machida in a slightly eye-opening scoreline, and FC Gifu are seventh after a 2-1 home win over Okayama. So, wrap up the match day for us.
I think I just echo the comments. I've only seen the highlights. I know our friends Dave and Liani, the Fortress Nozita and fellow Zelvista, would have been at the game, and they said the performance was kind of unmatched alike and quite limp and lifeless. And if you see the highlights of the goals, that definitely that checks out. You know, players just kind of not reacting to dangerous situations in the box. And it's one thing you very rarely can accuse Machida of, is kind of not being up for a game or you know, not being kind of energetic even when they don't win. But that certainly seemed to be whether they were tired or what, I'm not sure, but they just lacked they just didn't have enough spark, I don't think, to get anything out of their game. I think the third goal that Yamagata scored, a Jefferson Baiano kind of heading in pretty much on the goal line under the crossbar, I think if you're being very strict, there's a foul on the defender there, I think, but it was already 2-0 at that point, and I think the game had pretty much gone, so it's be clutching at straws, I think, to place too much importance on that. But yeah, I think it is the kind of result that a team can have now and again, but it's very important when you do have one of these, you know, sort of disappointing non-performances, if you like, that you bounce back quickly, and they've got a chance to do that at the weekend when they play another struggling team from the start of the season, then Kanazawa. So hopefully it's just a one-off and it's a blip. But a bit troubling. Losing a home game's no big thing in the grand scheme of things, but I think it's the manner of the defeat that would worry Naoki Sommer and Machida fans.
Yep, most definitely. All right, so let's look briefly ahead to match day four. There are three games on Saturday, and then the rest will be played on the Sunday, the 17th. The one of the three perfect teams after three games is in action on Saturday. That's a Ryukyu. They are hosting 14th placed Tokushima. So on paper, that looks a mismatch. But of course, we all know how Tokushima retooled in the off season, and their early season position is a very much a false one, I would suggest. And that will be a very stern test of Ryukyu and their perfect record. Then on Sunday, the two other perfect clubs are also in action, as you would expect. Mito host bottom-placed Chiba. So, yes, that's second, hosting 22nd. And the pick of the entire match day, I would suggest, is Kashiwa's trip to fifth-placed Kyoto on Sunday. That's a 2 o'clock kickoff at the Nishikyogoku Stadium. That looks the pick of the action, John. And, Raisel are probably just going to keep ticking these games off. But, for Kyoto, it's an excellent early test for them.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I think, like we said, Raisel, we expect to kind of stay third place or perhaps even higher throughout the season. Sanga or Kyoto, we kind of don't know yet. So yeah, it's a chance for them to lay down a marker, if you like. And Raisel, yeah, they've won all three games so far, but not the most impressive side, I don't think, from what I've seen. So yeah, I think there's a chance Kyoto could give them something to think about.
Yeah, most definitely. All right, then. So let's finish off the episode with a very brief look at match day one of the new J3 season, which got underway this past weekend. You talked about Ryukyu and Mito supporters maybe wanting to take a screenshot, John, of the current table. Well, the Gitovansk Kitakyushu supporters will want to do the same. They are top of the pile of the J3 after match day one. They won 2-0 at home over the juggernaut FC Tokyo under-23s. Of the two teams that you're probably the most familiar with, John, the two teams relegated from J2 at the end of last season. Well, Sanuki got off to a winning start with a 1-0 home win over Iwate, and Kumamoto drew 2-2 at home against Nagano. While the J3 new boys, Vanrore Hachinohe from Aomori, played out the same result at 2-2. That was away at Gumba Osaka under-23s. Hachinohe, a pretty impressive performance in their J3 opener. They came from a goal down to lead at 2-1, but to let that lead slip in a heartbreaking fashion in the 90th minute. So a point on debut for Hachinohe is a decent enough return, especially away from home. I mentioned Kitakyushu are top, John. Well, the team that are second are Tottori, and you saw them in action on Sunday at the Mitsuzawa Stadium. You were one of 1,610 at the Mitsuzawa Stadium to see Tottori win 4-3 away at YSCC.
It was a really end-to-end kind of pulsating game with so many goals, as you suggest, especially the first. It was 2-2 after the 20 minutes, so kind of we're averaging a goal every 5 minutes to start with, which is always a good thing. Yeah, and I think for me the best thing about the game was I was joined by no strangers to these parts, Gifu Richie, who descended from descended from Gifu for the weekend, and we had the option obviously of the big game between Yokohama Marinos and Kawasaki, but true to form, we binned that idea very quickly and went to watch a lower league game instead. And it was an interesting chance to see, both YSCC and Tottori under new management this season. So too early to draw any real conclusions, I think, from the first game, especially when it was such a kind of helter-skelter with, seeming every attack seemed to result in a goal, especially in the first, the first quarter of the game. But yeah, it was a fun day out, and it's a shame that there weren't more people in the stadium. The YSCC's kind of pre-season promotion was a target 2,000. You know, they were trying to get a crowd of 2,000 in for the first home game, but the weather forecast in advance was for pretty heavy rain. And obviously, as you know, Mitsuzawa, all the seats are open. There's no roof. There's no cover there. So in the end, it stayed dry, and Richie and I were able to enjoy a 7-goal thriller. But I think maybe the weather forecast perhaps put a few people off. I think Tottori winning perhaps made even more impressive by the fact that they only named 5 substitutes for the game. In J3, you're allowed to name 7, but they only brought a 16-man squad with them, so that was quite a baller, confident move, and it paid off just about with them getting the 3 points. The only other noteworthy thing me and Richie enjoyed discussing was at one point the referee showed a second yellow card to one of the Tottori players, Naoya Uozato, and he was sort of trudging off for his early bath, but then the referee actually changed his mind. Changed his mind, gave the free kick the other way, and rescinded the yellow, and he was able to carry on. So briefly, Tottori were down to 10 men, but then back up to 11 men before play had even restarted. I'm racking my brains to think if I've ever seen that at a game before. I don't think I have. So there you go, the magic of J3, Ben.
Terrific stuff. I'm just wondering, how did he get it across that he'd rescinded the card, John? Did he, like, point at it and make an X gesture with his arms, or did he just wave the player back on, or did he chase him down?
Yeah, anybody listening abroad, please don't be under any illusions. There's no VAR in J3. You know, it's not the Champions League. So literally, at one point, Richie was counting the YSCC players, and I was counting the Tottori players, and we came up with 11 each. And he, on the big screen scoreboard, his name was kind of deleted and taken off, and then it reappeared. So we, by process of elimination and sort of eavesdropping on a knowledgeable guy behind me, we worked it out. But no, it wasn't conveyed very clearly, and just added to the chaos, you know.
All right, fantastic stuff. Yeah, J3 off to a rollicking start then. All right, so that is it for our bumper episode of the J-Talk podcast, rounding up match day three in both J1 and J2, and yes, the start of the J3 season. John, fantastic to get your thoughts on the second tier through three games, and yes, indeed, to get that that fruity tale from Mitsuzawa on Sunday.
Yeah, no probs. The first few weeks of the season are always pretty busy for me with my day job, so apologies to anyone who's wanting sort of more in-depth, flavorful analysis, but hopefully as the weeks tick on, I'll be able to watch a few more games, and I'll have a few more kind of hard-hitting opinions as the season progresses. So, please bear with me.
All right, might be calling on you in a couple of weeks, John, for our first J2 special of the season, as an internationals break is coming up. So you are forewarned. But, for now, thanks for your time. I will speak to you soon, I'm sure.
Yeah, no problems. I hope everyone enjoys the 40, Ben. Yeah, take care.
All right, then. That is it, as I said, for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. My thanks again to Scott McIntyre, Alan Gibson, and John Steele, and, of course, to you for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to round up a big weekend in the J-League. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J-Talk podcast. Yes, 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 yes.